On today's College Football Inquirer, we're talking playoffs. That's right. The college football playoffs starts on Friday in Norman, Oklahoma, Alabama at Oklahoma, plus three games on Saturday. We get into the games, and then Ross Dellinger is going to tell us what may happen to the college football playoff next year, because he's been going through some of his old stories, and it turns out some of the commissioners, athletic directors, pretty much everybody else, diving into Ross's old stories and realizing, oh, we missed some stuff. We'll bring you up to speed. Plus, our I Got a Feeling picks on the playoff, and we predict our national champions, all on today's College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer with Stephen Godfrey and Ross Dellinger. I am Andy Staples, and it is time for the playoffs. That's right. We spend all season talking about the college football playoff. We talk about what the format's going to look like. We talk about all of the behind-the-scenes wrangling. Now it is time for them to actually play some games Friday night in Norman, Oklahoma. Alabama and Oklahoma will kick off this season's college football playoff. Boys, let's talk about the actual games.
Kind of weird to do that, to be honest. It's kind of, we only talk about this thing as the dysfunctional corporate executive mess, but there is actual tackle football being played this weekend.
I'll be at Norman. I know Andy, you'll be there. I mean, I'm flying to College Station the next morning, which isn't going to be a fun 4 o'clock.
Wait, you're flying? I'm driving. How? What?
I am. There's a flight out of Oklahoma City at 6 a.m. goes through Dallas, lands at College Station at 9:30 a.m.
Woo! So you're cutting it close. It is an 11 a.m. kickoff.
Yeah. Hour and a half to get to the stadium, but it's a 5-hour drive. What time are you leaving?
So that's a good question. My On3 co-host, Ari Wasserman, and I have to figure out the travel logistics. He does live in Dallas, so there's we could get to his house Friday night, sleep for a few hours, and then go. I'm thinking, though, we may be Ardmore, Oklahoma, sleep, get up at 4 in the morning and drive, and get to College Station around 9. That's what I'm thinking, because Kyle Field traffic is bad, bad, bad. So yeah. you want to be...
I'm concerned about that. Yeah, I'm really concerned about that. I'm thinking that there's a chance that I miss kickoff probably because I land like at 9:40 a.m. And the College Station airport is really close to
You could walk campus. To the stadium from there.
And yeah. I might have to. It's probably like a 25-minute walk.
There are tailgates. There basically are tailgates in the airfield.
Yeah.
Not really. I'm sure the FAA would protest that. But... The tailgate lots
FAA.
Are very close to the airfield.
Yeah.
Maybe not this FAA. Ardmore, Oklahoma is on my list. Which one of you stayed there?
Oh, yeah.
Me.
Someone stayed there this year.
That was me.
Okay. Yeah. Elkhart, Commerce, Harrisonburg, all the sexy places.
The other option is Gainesville, Texas, right on the Red River. So we may go a little bit further south, but it just depends on how we're feeling.
Boy, this podcast is not for the elites. We are real Americans.
No, it's not.
Good Lord.
No, it is not. But back to the game, right? I saw a stat where no team in 130 years has beaten Alabama twice in the same season. I don't even know who that team was 130 years ago.
How often has Alabama played the same team twice
in
the same season?
Probably not too often, right? I mean, I think about LSU. In the championship,
they have a chance to
do it.
Georgia lost Georgia them the first times, time, but then beat probably. Them in the national title game.
Yeah, Georgia probably a couple times. Yeah, had a chance to do it. I'm going to guess a dozen times maybe that a team had a chance to beat Alabama twice in a season in 130 years, and none of them have done it. So maybe the Sooners are the pick.
Remember, Kalen DeBoer at Alabama 0-2 against Brent Venables' Oklahoma teams.
Yeah.
One of my favorite pieces of lore about that Alabama year that you're referencing, Ross, was the 9-6 game in Tuscaloosa. Mm. We're going to trade field goals, play defense. But do you remember the primary offense that LSU used to get in position for those field goals was that basically they ran the Nebraska option in that game.
Dive or what?
Pretty much.
They didn't run the option until the national title game. The national title game, they came out running the option. They couldn't get across the 50.
Well, what I'm saying was they ran a very, very, very reductive offense. And then Bama got better at that. And then when they came out in the national title game, they couldn't cross the 50. And it was mainly because Bama got lit up by a triple option Jeff Munkin team in the interim, and they actually learned how to fit it better. And then the ill-fated LSU Superdome incident, as they called it.
And then, of course, Alabama's offense, that was Jim McElwain, I believe, was a coordinator at the time, basically was like, oh, all we ever do is run on first and second down. Let's just throw on first down, see what happens. And sure enough, LSU defense, which had 11 NFL starters on it, was suddenly susceptible.
Arguably one of the worst coaching jobs in a national championship game we've ever seen was that LSU staff.
Yeah, pretty bad.
Anyway, shut up.
But so this is going to be a fascinating situation, because we talk about Ross and I going back and forth between Norman and College Station. I would argue that if either of the teams in College Station were playing either of the teams in Norman, the teams playing in College Station would be the winners of the game, because those teams are built in ways that they can run the ball, they can throw the ball, they can get after your quarterback. Alabama and Oklahoma cannot run the ball. Like, there's no, like, we're going to pick our national champions later in the show. There's no chance I'd pick either of these teams as my national champion, because they can't do one of the basic things. Neither one can do it.
There was an anonymous scouting report in The Athletic this week. I think they said that Oklahoma has a great defense. Offense couldn't piss a drop, I believe is what they said. That was an anonymous opposing coach.
They somehow managed to get Isaiah Satania open pretty frequently. So I'm holding out for the big play from Oklahoma. Alabama, I'm a little concerned about. So Ty Simpson looked injured in the Georgia game, looked slowed, because he's a very good athlete. He's a very good runner. He was not moving very well. If you can't move against Oklahoma's defense as a quarterback, you're in trouble, because they will send so many people at you.
I think you could argue something is up in the Ty Simpson mechanics related department, kind of the same way we talked about Mateer rushing back from the injury earlier this season, and or offensive line issues. Let's just say maybe not injury, but just issues the way they looked against Georgia in the SEC championship, which is very foreboding this time of year. Andy, are you going to go so far as to say this is a poorly arranged first round because these two teams are lesser than the other two in College Station?
Yeah. Well, my prediction coming out of it was that Miami and Notre Dame would make the playoff and Alabama would drop out. But Oklahoma and Ole Miss, if you did the, you know, use our friend Parker Fleming's matchup tool, Oklahoma and Ole Miss would be behind Miami, Notre Dame as well, and probably Texas A&M. So that's the thing. I'm just looking at how teams are built. And like, if I'm Ohio State sitting there about to play the winner of Texas A&M, Miami, I'm like, how come we have to play one of these two? Like, that sucks. Everybody else got it easier than us.
Sounds like a bias against the Southeastern, or for the Southeastern Conference, Andy.
Why is that? Like, Miami's not in the Southeastern Conference.
No. I'm saying that these teams would be favored over Ole Miss. These teams would be favored over Oklahoma. You were talking it sounds like the lesser SEC teams got the benefit of the doubt in seeding.
Because of when they lost and how they lost. That's it.
Narrative construction in the season. This is what we're seeing. I can take any football conversation and take it back to the inefficiencies of this selection committee.
A&M is seeded higher than Oklahoma and would be favored in a game against Oklahoma.
Right.
It's not that. But it's Miami is...
Hey, man, we got to keep the Notre Dame audience. We got to keep the Notre Dame. We got to keep them for at least a month, all right? I got to get them in the segment.
They're not eating Pop-Tarts. But Miami is constructed in a way that you would usually expect a good SEC team to be constructed. Alabama and Oklahoma were good SEC teams. They did win 10 games in the season. Mm-hmm. But again, I come back to, they can't run the ball, which is going to be a problem at some point in this tournament.
Well, and like one of the things that Godfrey mentioned, the scouting report in like about Oklahoma can't piss a drop. Well, before Mateer was hurt, I feel like Oklahoma was pissing more drops. And then he got hurt, and maybe 3 weeks of off maybe will help him heal, and we may see the one that we saw the first half of the season, the offense that at least moved the ball a little better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the thing is, can he generate run game for them? Because that's what he was doing early in the season before the injury.
Yeah.
because they're getting nothing out of their backs. And
I would argue that his inability to set up the run at home against Ole Miss is why Ole Miss got that quality win. That was the least of the Oklahoma offense with Metier, I thought, this season.
Yeah. So now all of this bagging on them, one of them is going to win this game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I picked Alabama to win, and I'm kind of a little nervous about that. The injury or the availability report came out. Josh Cuevas, the tight end, is questionable. I think he's fairly important to their pass protection and what does exist of their run game. And if you look at the first Alabama-Oklahoma game, he was kind of the safety blanket for Ty Simpson in that game. So I'm a little concerned there. Also concerned from the Alabama standpoint, like, R. Mason Thomas is back for Oklahoma. We haven't seen him since the Tennessee game. Like, so that's an already ferocious pass rush that gets maybe its best rusher back.
Yeah. And Ty, as Godfrey said, was reading some stories this week from out of Tuscaloosa, and it does seem that there's at least suggestions that Ty Simpson isn't completely 100%. I guess he addressed it with media saying that he's fine or something like that, like waving it off. And then the next thing he said was, well, you know, every team isn't 100%. It's playoff time.
Well, yeah. He also has had a couple weeks since he played, so he might be okay. And if he is, I'll take if Ty Simpson is close to 100% health or anywhere near it, I will take the Ty Simpson third, fourth down magic that I saw in the middle of the season.
Absolutely. No. You know, impartially, I would like to see Oklahoma win this only because the healthiest or maximum amount of Oklahoma pass rush that you mentioned, Andy, would be the most interesting against Mendoza in the next round to me.
Yes.
But this is an exciting game. It's weird as I say this. I can hear myself talking about how like Alabama wouldn't provide a more entertaining or engaging on-field story, if you will. But this Alabama team, it's all kind of post-Saban. It's just interesting to me that they're not physically or schematically more interesting than their opponent, which was kind of how we always viewed Alabama under Saban. But this is the closest and most interesting game in the first round. The other thing I'm watching for in all these games, since we're hemming and we're hawing, folks, those are literal descriptive terms about two group of five teams in this bracket and sullying the great institution. What's the margin of victory in these games? Because last year's margin of victory wasn't particularly close in the first round.
Every first round game was a blowout.
Yep.
Everyone. Mm-hmm. So the question
just like
is
the old semifinals of the four team. Remember that?
Yep. Yeah.
Except for the year when you had you always had one semi that was good. Like that Rose Bowl, the Oklahoma-Georgia Rose Bowl. Yeah, you had the Ohio State-Georgia Peach Bowl. But,
man,
yeah.
You also had that Fiesta Bowl I covered where like Ohio State opted out at kickoff against Clemson.
The Clemson one? Yeah. Not the Clemson one in 19, the Clemson one in 17.
Yeah,
or 16.
Yeah. In, 16. Yeah, yeah. It was, I know it was in the Fiesta because I remember thinking like I'd leave the stadium and write my gamer right now, but there's nothing but parking lots and desert.
Well, one other thing about this Alabama-Oklahoma game, how about Brent Venables? I wrote a column about this for On3. It was only 8 weeks ago that Brent Venables was being asked about his job.
Yeah.
Like, so the Tuesday after Brian Kelly gets fired, Brent Venables has just lost to Ole Miss. Their next two games are at Tennessee, which was 6-2 at the time, and at Alabama, which was 7-1 at the time. And it's looking pretty grim for Brent Venables. And now he's got them where they need to be. Like, it doesn't matter if they win this game as far as his job security. But if he can win this game and then go play Indiana and have a chance to upset the number one seed, I mean, that's a pretty hell of a dramatic turnaround for 2 months.
On the heels of losing a Red River they weren't supposed to. This was
getting
this
destroyed was as, in a Red River
yeah.
that they were supposed to win.
They were as against the wall as a coaching staff as they've been. I wonder if they're able to win this game, regardless of what would happen hypothetically against Indiana, if this isn't just, I wonder what the case study on Brent Venables will be, or if it's just specific to the situation in Norman, where there's this perception of underperformance, big cultural transition, personnel doesn't seem to fit. Can this guy do it in the SEC? He's never been a head coach. And then they really go until the last minute in terms of a referendum on a coach. because I do think there was a legitimate evaluation of other candidates and putting someone else in that job. Look,
Joe Castiglione, the longtime AD, announces he's stepping down. They've got Randall Stephenson, the ex-AT&T CEO, who installs Jim Nagy as the GM, who's searching for the new athletic director. Like, everything was set up to move on from Brent Venables if they had to. And now
you
he's
said
good-
it in week one. On this show, you said it in week one, mentioning like, hey, this is table setting to move on after the season if it doesn't work out.
But I will say, and from talking to people there, the relationship between Jim Nagy and Brent Venables is really good. They seem to work together very well. Mm-hmm. And the other piece of this is sometimes when you're in a head coaching job for the first time, you learn things as you go. And Brent Venables has evolved as a head coach in the four seasons that he's been one.
What a shocking concept, the idea of learning on the job. Based on the hiring trends of this past cycle, no one is allowing for that space. We want proven head coaching experience in almost every one of these roles, with just a very few exceptions. Like, Will Stein is more about a culture change at Kentucky. And then if I had to rack my brain off the top of my head, then we're going to like Brian Hartline at South Florida.
USF, yeah.
What I'm
like
saying
Glenn
is everybody
sitting there at Georgia, the DC, like.
Right. Which
normally
was Dan Lanning's old
job. Yeah.
Dan Lanning's old job. Just want to throw that out there. Dan Lanning's old job. So it's interesting to me if anyone's going to pay any attention to Venables as a case study in the offseason, because the cycle was so biased against guys with top tier coordinator experience and a robust resume. And in Venables' case, like, what, number one or somewhere between number one and number five active DC for the last however many years, right? Was coveted while he was at Clemson. So I'm curious if this shakes the mindset up a little bit.
You guys got to be more patient with the first-time head coaches. And I'm just not sure. The money involved now makes it hard to be patient. As we talk about it with Michigan looking for a head coach.
Well, like, and Michigan's not looking for a coordinator either.
Nope.
No. Mm-mm. Well, I don't want to put us in a ditch here. That one I sort of understand, because you got to come in with all the experience and all of the intangible, hypothetical crisis management ability. You almost need like a crisis comm CEO type of mentality, based on everything that's going on above you and below you in Ann Arbor right now.
Well, and it's interesting. I'll tie this into another playoff game. So Miami, Texas A&M finally overcomes whatever demons have plagued the Aggies for years and years, and they make the playoff. We give a lot of credit to Mike Elko for that.
We do.
Now, Mike Elko was the Duke head coach for 2 years before he became the A&M head coach. My question is, did he need those 2 years at Duke, or could he have just ascended from DC at Texas A&M to head coach there and then done this?
I'm going to say this because I know all three of us know this. He was favored by a lot of people in College Station. He was very well liked because the person he replaced was so very cold to the booster group, to the, let's just call it, the culture in College Station. You know, as Jimbo grew more and more standoffish, I talked about this a lot when we were explaining the Lane Kiffin situation. There's always another coach who sort of picked up the slack when the sort of hyper big character head coach didn't want to do that kind of stuff. Jimbo was like this. Lane Kiffin is like this. Mike Elko was the guy who did the glad handing, who would go shoot the you know what with the boosters. So, Andy, to answer your question, I think they would have grabbed him because they knew him, because he had institutional knowledge and great relationships. But I do think they felt certified and bona fide, to go back to the storyline that you've talked about before, where Mark Stoops is on the precipice of that job, a longtime SEC head coach coming in, the thinking being we can flood money and be a bigger Kentucky and give him a bigger chance to sort of win at a premier SEC school. I think having Duke head coach next to his resume all but certified it. I think he would have been successful regardless.
Like, he was, he outperformed
absolutely
Duke's normal expectations. Yeah.
Also real fast. It what plagued A&M and what should be another case study in the offseason is hubris. They chased money. They chased an idea with Jimbo. They've been doing it for years. I mean, look, if money won national titles, A&M would have 20 of them, right? They finally went after the unsexy, practical choice, and it has paid off for them in a way that we haven't seen in the SEC.
And what's amazing is, so that 2022 recruiting class, the number one recruiting class, the only person making news out of that class this year, or this week, is LT Overton, who isn't playing for Alabama. He's out on the availability report. He transferred from Texas A&M to Alabama. Like, that that class was supposed to be the one that brought A&M here, it really hasn't been. There are some guys from that class that are playing for A&M in this game, but it really has been more Elko getting the roster where it needs to be instead of just saying, oh, we're going to sign the top seven defensive linemen in the country and it doesn't really matter if we need some people in other positions.
I, you know, it's funny. I'm glad you brought that up because it, I know we're not talking about the next round yet. It makes me want to applaud Joey McGuire. And that's something I don't think we've done on this show or we haven't really talked about. We talked about the expectations being sort of out of whack. If Texas Tech wasn't going to make the playoff, they'd potentially make a change, go off and chase a big name hire. It's not as simple as paying them. Again, this is not plug and play. This is not transactional. You still have to coach them. You still have to create a team chemistry and culture. You know, on my other show, Phantom Island, we talked a lot about, okay, all jokes aside, why is North Carolina failing? It's because they're treating it too professionally. One of the things that we talked about, including talking with some former UNC players, is you can't just bring guys in who don't understand why you want to beat NC State and Duke and don't understand what the culture is and don't have any communication with one another. Elko's a college football head coach, decidedly unsexy compared to national title winning Jimbo Fisher. And it just works because he does all those things that aren't really interesting in the offseason and don't really grab headlines in season. And he probably doesn't use hashtags on Twitter.
And he also appreciates line of scrimmage play, and so does his counterpart in this game, Mario Cristobal.
FFCs, that, baby.
Yeah.
That is what makes me so excited to see this game because these teams are built on the line of scrimmage, how you have to build to win a national title. And if I had to say, is there a game in the first round where both teams might have a chance to win the national title? This would be the one.
Mm. Yep. That's a good point. They've spent and got the talent to do it. And they've shown enough flashes this year to be able to potentially win the national title. You know, it is funny when you look at these two like head coaching matchups. You know, you got defensive guy. I think Elko, he wasn't a lineman. He was a safety, maybe? He was like a DB or something.
Right.
But, you know, he was defensive guy. And then you got Mario. You got Mario, obviously offensive lineman. And certainly has at Oregon and now at Miami has built up those lines to a point, and Dan Lanning's just kind of continued it at Oregon. And so you have these two defensive, offensive-minded sort of guys meeting. And I think Elko calls the defense, right?
He does.
He calls the defense.
He does.
It should be a fascinating sort of game against Shannon Dawson, Miami's offensive coordinator, and all their weapons that they have, especially on the perimeter.
Malachi, I think Miami Tony, baby G.
Yeah,
think about baby think Jesus. How good do you have to be? For those who don't know, Malachi Tony, the freshman receiver at Miami, his nickname from high school is Baby Jesus. This is how good he is, because this is not a case of everybody in South Florida is sacrilegious or anything like that. It is somebody said it when he was in high school. Somebody called him Baby Jesus, and his high school coach is like, "We're not calling him that." And then he plays this incredible game, and his high school coach is like, okay, we can call him that.
Remember, he moved to quarterback. He was receiver in high school. The last few games, he moved to quarterback because of an injury, including the state championship game. He was, like, thrown in there as the quarterback. And I think he went, like, you know, 14 of 14 or something like that and ran all over the field. And afterward, the high school coach was like, you know what? I'm going to call him Baby Jesus now.
Call him whatever I can.
It's okay. I'm willing to take that step. So take that risk. Lightning
Miami,
bolt. Hit me.
Miami keeping Shannon Dawson. I know Shannon Dawson kind of making his way around, could have potentially moved up to a couple head coaching jobs, but keeping him in place. I always kind of keep a little bit of an eye on these other bowl games that don't matter. It's always interesting to see what product you put out when you have short staff, interim staff, and then also, you know, who opts out or whatever. The more intact teams, as this playoff has sort of been defined early by coaches gone, coaches that wanted to be there, can't, all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Miami going in at sort of full strength in the box is also important.
Because Colin Klein, the A&M offensive coordinator, is going to be the head coach's alma mater, Kansas State.
Yep.
Actually, let's
and
can we do the
list coordinator too?
And their defensive coordinator, Jay Bateman,
even
is
though
in Kentucky.
He doesn't call the
plays, but he doesn't call it. I'm only worried about play callers. But yeah, you
know, yeah, clearly.
But
damn,
but,
Andy.
I'm sorry, Mike Elko yanked that away last year.
They're still coaching on the field, man.
They're two of 14 coaches of 8 playoff teams that have already taken another job.
Yeah, I want to make the list because we haven't done this yet, and I don't think I've seen this done like in total. So, Oregon, their offensive coordinator Will Stein is headed to be Kentucky's head coach. They are playing James Madison, whose head coach, Bob Chesney, has been announced as UCLA's head coach.
Mm-hmm.
Ole Miss, well, we talked about that one the most.
Yeah.
Lane Kiffin gone and not coming back. He's the LSU head coach. He's not coaching, but the offensive staff is coaching at Ole Miss and then leaving for LSU. So they're
after
doing double
signing, after already signing with their chief conference rival.
Yes.
Bizarre. The whole thing is bizarre. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you and what else, Andy? This
They're playing Tulane, where John Summerall is going to be Florida's head coach. So we just mentioned Miami, mostly intact. Texas A&M, Colin Klein going to Kansas State. Alabama, they why am I blanking
Jamarcus
on?
Jamarcus
Shepard is going to Oregon State.
Receivers coach. And then Ohio State's Brian Hartline.
Is going to be USF head coach.
So only four of the 12 teams are in. Their staffs are intact as having not taken any.
Oklahoma intact. That's interesting.
Oklahoma, Indiana, Georgia, and Texas Tech.
The one that's
Indiana
is
the one
Indiana.
I'm surprised about too, because two coordinators who could have gotten jobs, but back to Godfrey's point.
Yeah.
Yes. No. I. The Indiana tree, I think, is coming. I think right now, I got asked on my other show on Phantom Island about. What's the difference between like a Kurt Cignetti tract and a Lance Leipold tract, you know, like a non-traditional football school? And it's hard to dress some of these answers up and talk football. And you can for a minute. And it comes down to they are spending, folks. Indiana's keeping their staff together. They're keeping their roster together because they are financially dedicated. It's a short answer, but it's the most accurate one.
And Big Ten schools have lots of money. And if they put it in the correct places, any of them can win.
Sure.
You hear me, Minnesota? You hear me, Illinois? You hear me, Wisconsin? Any of you can do this.
Yep. I'm going to go back.
Not you, Purdue. Go sit down.
I
didn't do that. Them. Andy did it. It was the sin of omission. I just finished the joke.
How dare you?
I go back to visiting Scott Dolson, the AD at Indiana, last November and doing kind of an Indiana football story built around Kurt Cignetti. I just went back to my story because it jibes with what you're saying. I was writing about sort of the Kirk Schulz is a part of the story, which is the former Washington State president. And he, at one point, I think he said publicly as he was retiring that there's going to be more of a curing of conferences, right? That which is what happened in the Pac-12, right? The elimination
Kirk,
of the little guys.
Also the K-State president while the Big 12 was trying to blow itself up.
Right. So he's seen a lot of this. And he was meaning, you know, obviously the curing of conferences, bigger brands leaving behind their little brothers. And I asked Scott Dolson about that when I was at Indiana last November. And this was his quote to me. In the Big Ten, you need to be relevant in football to be a relevant member of your conference. We don't take for granted that we're always a longstanding member of the Big Ten. We want to pay our fair share and be a valued member in football.
Buddy,
and I think they're just throwing all of it at it, man.
The subtext of that quote, while sounding sort of boilerplate on its face,
Not at all. The subtext
of that quote should be tattooed on the forehead of every have-not Big Two university in the next 5 years. If you can't pick up what he's saying, you're probably already dead.
Yeah, I mean, he basically is saying, without saying, like we're going to be left behind if we don't start winning in football and pouring resources in it. You know,
so Indiana, Vanderbilt, you've seen it. It's possible.
Yeah, you can do it.
That's right. All right, so we talked about talk about the games that are played this weekend. This tournament that is happening now. Ross Dellinger has some very interesting details about what the tournament will look like in the future and the battle for what it will look like in the future when we come back. We're back at the College Football Inquirer, and remember, if you would like to see how delightful Ross's beanie is today, go to Yahoo Sports Network. The easiest way to do it is turn on your smart TV, look on the home screen. You will see that Yahoo Sports Network icon. Click on that, and you can watch all the Yahoo Sports Network shows, including the College Football Inquirer. Or if you're on the go, if you got your tablet, your phone, your laptop, go to yahoosports.tv.
Yeah.
What Andy. Are we? What are we? Oh, is that a?
Yeah.
Is that a Delaware?
Friends, is it Delaware?
Our recently victorious bowl-winning
friends.
Congrats
on your first bowl victory, yeah, Delaware
go.
Blue Hens.
There we go, Blue
again,
Hens.
Again, as the mainstream media continues to castigate Group of Five football, not here, sir, because hashtag Blue Hen bias. I invented that this week.
Speaking
thank
of
you
that,
to our friends at Delaware.
And yeah? The G5 playoff talk to our...
That's right. Thank you. Go Blue Hens, and thank you for the gear.
Go.
Don't send exactly any, right. don't, they don't need any, just me.
YahooSports.tv to see this beautiful Blue Hens varsity jacket that Godfrey's wearing.
It's like a warm up. It's nice.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. very good. Nice. All right, am I taking it away, Andy?
You are taking away? It away because
so, it's kind of like a congressional minute.
Yeah.
No, it's kind of like Ross reviews a story that he published a year and a half ago.
A year and a half ago,
and that all the people in college sports forgot about.
Freak out! They forgot. Yeah. It's wild. It's been. Bizarre. I don't know. I've been kind of really surprised by it, but I guess everybody had to sort of have a example of this new format coming next year. So let me explain. So, you know, a year and a half ago, and we've talked about this on the show quite a bit, the memorandum of understanding that the 11 entities of the CFP, the 10 FBS conferences in Notre Dame, agreed to included the guarantees around a new format starting with the new contract, which starts next year. So even if there is an expansion, even if they don't agree on any expansion to next year's playoff, they already agreed a year and a half ago on guarantees built in this MOU. And the two main guarantees, one, as we discussed on the show a week and a half ago, Notre Dame gets a guaranteed access to the playoff if they're in the top 12 of a 12-team playoff, in the top 13 of a 14-team playoff. But a lot of that also depends on how many at-larges, seven or fewer, seven or more. It gets a little complicated, but the bottom line is Notre Dame has that guarantee. So this year, for instance, Notre Dame would have been in the playoff because they were ranked number 11, and Miami would have been out. Okay, so the second thing is that the current format calls for the five highest-ranked conference champions to get an automatic qualifier, not designated to a specific league. In the MOU signed a year and a half ago and starting next year, there is a designation per league. The Big Ten, SEC, ACC, and Big 12, their champion is automatically included in the field. And then there's one reserved for the non-power league, highest-ranked non-power league champion. So the field would be different in that regard as well. Duke would be in the field as the ACC champion, and JMU would be out of the field. So, and of course this happens, right? Like this change that happens next year precedes two Group of Fives, which they never thought that would happen, right? Like when they mm-hmm. built the playoff, they never thought that would happen because partly the playoff was built for five, you know, fairly
power
equal
conferences,
and now yeah. we really have two power conferences in a lot of ways. So, boom, here we are with two G5s, and going to next year based on the MOU, that will probably not ever happen again, unless they expand the playoff to, like, you know, over 16.
Well, this
oh,
is my question.
Oh, it's never because, happening again.
Because what you wrote is that it's for 12 or 14.
Yeah.
Now right. we hear everybody pushing for 16. If it is yeah. 16, if they decide next year is going to be a 16-team field, does all of that still translate, or do they have to hash it all out again?
That's a great question, and I'm being asked about that a lot, and I don't have any answers because it depends on who you ask. You get a different answer. If you ask people who are, you know, like the Notre Dame people, for instance,
yeah.
right? They're like, oh, yeah, well, the guarantee stays. They're just, the guarantee maybe kind of moves and
you
shifts.
You move it to 15 or something,
but,
yeah.
right. But like it stays. Well, you ask other people and they're like, well, no, everything's got to be renegotiated. Nothing stays. So I'm guessing there'll be a renegotiation of some sort. And the tenants, the main concepts of the guarantees will probably be the same, or certainly they'll be negotiated over. That could be another fight altogether.
Can I ask you what one thing I'm curious about with the designating ACC, SEC, Big 10, Big 12 champions get in? I remember back when Kevin Warren was the Big Ten commissioner, before he was trying to make the Chicago Bears the Gary Bears, if you don't follow the NFL.
Oh, man,
that's
you took my joke. Oh, you took my joke.
But when Kevin Warren was the Big Ten commissioner, he was fighting against the conception of the 12-team playoff that was created by Greg Sankey and Bob Bowlsby and Craig Thompson and Jack Swarbrick, because he wanted guarantees that the Big Ten champ would get in and by extension, all of the power conference champs.
Which
and
the Big Ten actually, champ's always going to get in.
Well, I think the ACC probably thought that too. But it was Greg Sankey and Bob Bowlsby at the time who fought back the hardest on that. Bowlsby was the Big 12 commissioner at the time, who said, this is an antitrust issue. We got to be careful here. What changed? Because clearly the SEC and the Big 12 are now on board with this. So how did that change?
Well, I think you said it, right? I think the ACC in sort of their situation and the Big 12 without Texas and Oklahoma in their situation, I'm sure they fought pretty hard for having an actual guaranteed spot, number one, to make sure that they're in the field. And yeah, that would have paid off this year for the ACC on a year that they were down, and they're going to fix the tiebreakers, but the tiebreaker thing happened with Miami and not getting into the championship game. And I do think, Andy, that there is a little bit of influence from, big surprise, the TV networks here.
What?
Because they all
well, there's only one TV network that that does the playoff.
Huh. Well,
their publicist tells me all the time in angry emails that they're not involved in this stuff, Ross. So you better explain yourself.
There are many TV networks, Andy, that air the conference championship games, which are now an automatic bid into the playoff, gotcha. no matter what it is, ACC, Big Ten, whatever. And I think that was sort of behind, always thought to be behind, Kevin Warren's argument for an automatic bid for designated.
Wait, are you insinuating that Fox was puppeteering the Big Ten commissioner? What?
No, me, no. So yeah, everybody wants their game to count and be as valuable as possible. So I think that was part of that going forward as well. And they probably didn't want to ever see happen what literally happened this year, where you have two group of fives into the playoff, which of course, as I wrote in that story,
because you know when that
today,
happens, a hell mouth opens and college football is done.
It's amazing. This has become, gosh, a really intense. You guys saw what Joel Klatt said about the NCAA tournament and the AQs
I got
and
some
little
words
dogs
for that.
And no Cinderellas.
He stepped in that one.
I am confused. I am confused about, and I think college athletics is confused in a way right now about what it wants college athletics to be. And not just talking about playoffs and things like that, right? Off the field and athlete compensation. We can go all different areas, but like forever, college athletics has been a place for where you give the underdogs a chance. And we're seeing that slowly be eliminated. And partly we're seeing that be eliminated because probably the money involved in college athletics right now.
It's not probably. It's not probably.
The football powers are trying their best, clearly, to slowly cut out the chance of an underdog in a big upset. And we see that play out the NCAA tournament, and it's why it's such a great event. And I just don't get why people continue to crap on it.
Because but here's the thing, and this is where Joel's wrong, but I'm not going to go as far as Godfrey's going to go. Joel's wrong because the upsets are what make the NCAA tournament great. Now, ideally, you want those upsets in round one. You don't want those upset teams getting into the second weekend. You want big dogs in the second weekend. But you want that. And in basketball, it's entirely possible. There are going to be a lot of instances, and it'll happen every NCAA tournament, where the lower-seeded team or the team from the mid-major or the team from the low-major conference has the best player on the floor. And if you have the best player on the floor, you have a chance to win the game. I'll take you back to the when Butler played Duke for the national championship. Gordon Hayward was the best player on the floor, and Butler almost won that game.
Yeah.
When James Madison plays Oregon on Saturday, the 22 starters for Oregon will be better than all 22 starters at their positions for James Madison.
Where, Andy, where? So, James Madison has their best player is the 23rd best player on the field, basically, in the game?
Pretty much, yeah. Think? Yeah. Okay. Now, that's not always going to be the case. Now, you'll have a team. You'll have a,
well, like Tulane, a group of five. Tulane's got some players probably at right. Ole Miss that, you know, yes. their best player might be the 15th best player.
Correct. Field, you know? But Ole Miss is going to have the top 10. Yeah. And that's the, like, football and basketball are different. The depth required to win a football game versus winning a basketball game in an upset situation.
I mean, that's a good argument. Much different. It is. It's a good argument. But hey, we do remember last year. I mean, I know Penn State ended up beating Boise, but we've seen Boise in some of those.
Now, Ashton Gentry was probably the second best player on the field.
And they hung around.
Or the best. Yeah.
The third quarter. So. Yeah. But Godfrey is ready to unleash hell, I believe. So I'm going to give.
No. I
can't
do it every
week. I'm going to give him the floor.
I can't do it every week. I'm ready for you, Godfrey. I appreciate the cuteness and the Disneyfication of it, but it's funny that I say Disneyfication because Disney's the one kind of pulling the strings here. But.
You really set me up. I appreciate this.
But I want to set the tee too for Godfrey by saying one last thing.
Yeah. Okay.
I think Joel Klatt, who I enjoy, I like Joe and Joel, and his show's really good, right? Does good stuff. But one of the things he said was the NCAA tournament isn't the best 68 teams, right? Yes, that's true.
But it's got the best. You've got 30, the best. At least you've the, got best the best 34.
Yeah. Fine. You probably have the best like 40, 45. Probably.
Yeah, because you have the conference chance and in the majors.
College football playoff, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't have the best 12, but it probably has the best 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. So do we have to? Does everything have to be the best?
These craven greedy bastards I'm just telling you right now, these craven greedy bastards are not going to stop until they strangle every element of life out of this thing while simultaneously pointing at stuff like NIL as the downfall of the sport. Does no one remember the multitude of G5 upsets in the partner bowls in the 4-team format? I am not advocating that JMU is going to beat Oregon. I am not. Tulane, I think, is going to have a puncher's chance because anyone who thinks Oxford is a stable place right now, like that one, I would arch an eyebrow at Tulane and Ole Miss.
There's also the intimidating home field environment at your alma mater. Wait,
that's why I left, folks. Just putting it on blast. I put this on social. About 800 Confederate flag waving a holes got in my mentions, and they're like, "I can't believe you're doing that." He talked about the crowds. He talked about how bad the stadium was. And then he left your ass. And I was right. Anyway, USC and Tulane, what about best player on the field there?
Yeah.
Okay. What about the upstart UCF teams? What about? I can do this almost once a bracket.
I would argue the upstart UCF team, like 2017 UCF against 2017 Auburn. Shaquille Griffin's one of the best five players on the field. So Shaquem Griffin is one of the best five players on the field. Yeah. And he plays for UCF.
Yeah, it kind of proves my point, though. This idea that we're going to create some sort of clean break, and it's only going to be these 30 helmets, because we love our helmets. We love our big corporate billionaire helmets.
I love that you think it's 30, Godfrey.
It's not 30.
Like, if
it's
we
an arbitrary
TV executive,
number.
It's probably 18. So.
Yeah, exactly. This is disgusting. The Trojan horse of the week that they use to create these completely ridiculous arguments. Just do the damn thing already. But what I won't stand for is the idea that you're then going to turn around and represent all these other conferences with TV deals. And like ESPN specifically, as the primary carrier of college football and the sole carrier technically of the playoff, they license out those other games, by the way. The amount of punditry that they have platformed, just absolutely denigrating. I'm going to interrupt myself. I go back to one principle. Everybody should have access to college football. You should be able to love it. I don't think there should be five G5 teams in. I believe in a level of meritocracy. But if you take away the tiniest, most symbolic representation of, quote, having a chance, Andy, when they put the auto bid, which is not technically an auto bid, I understand that. Mm-hmm. We don't need to do that again. But the idea that one group of five team could make the field of 12, I said, it's perfect. Leave it alone. It's perfect now, because now it's incumbent upon those 20-odd G5 teams with a puncher's chance to schedule correctly, to build their rosters correctly, and essentially to live and die in an in-season playoff for that one bid to then go out and play.
And
teams.
The one you get is probably best prepared to handle the role.
Yeah. So all last year, all I heard about was Alabama being shunned and we've been picked on and how dare we? And I can't believe this. Because look at those teams. And by the way, most Alabama fans I saw on social media and radio still thought SMU was in the American. Guys, you couldn't beat a Michigan team without a quarterback in your bowl game. So don't give me that, okay?
Yeah.
Last year's games have not been used as a data point at all by any of these ESPN pundits. The multitude of games we joked about in the earlier segment, by and large, if anything, and man, I'm going to be careful how I say this, Some years you could start arguing about the BCS methodology versus this. The idea that one group of five team doesn't belong, or the idea that it's the group of five's fault that the ACC soiled itself in church all season long, that's not James Madison's fault. And I don't care if you're upset that Oregon's going to have an easier game. You made the rules.
I think the fact that Duke lost to two group of five teams kind of proves your point.
Like, I'm going to have an aneurysm. Put it in the thumbnail. Podcaster has aneurysm. Put it in the thumbnail. I have joked with little barbs while Ross was talking about the reportage of this. This will never happen again. They will bend over backwards to prevent this from happening again. But I want to ask you guys this, not you, the greater, like every single person I know has gone on some tirade. Yes. Like every one of those, you know, from Feinbaum to all the bussing with the bro boys, all that stuff. What would you rather watch this weekend? Would you rather watch James Madison against Oregon, or would you rather watch Duke against Oregon?
I'd rather watch Notre Dame against Oregon.
That's okay to say. But again, we've sidestepped all that, and we're blaming Tulane and JMU for existing. How many times in other segments?
I would be getting Notre Dame Ole Miss.
Which would be a fantastic game, by the way.
Yeah.
I know that, like, I'm not trying to stretch this out. But how many segments on other topics do we have to mention to you guys again? The group of five, Cam Ward. I've told the Cam Ward story. Look at the coaches who have just been hired up.
Well, Cam Ward came out of the FCS first.
Correct. Like this idea, I'm about to pick an FCS game, which I sort of shoehorn into this show. The idea that this stuff is completely irrelevant has and always will be false. Okay? It's all a giant feeder system. All these ADs that are talking all this, most of them started in the group of five or the FCS. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's how the trickle down economics of those SoCon Saturdays work. It is mind-boggling to me that we are going to strangle out one of the last pieces of unique tradition in this sport to possibly make a couple extra $100 million on a matchup that might suck anyway. Because Clemson and Texas was interesting for two quarters last year. Penn State SMU was not interesting. Help me on the other two games because I can't remember them.
Indiana Notre Dame wasn't interesting. I was.
Oh my God! No, that was a mercy killing.
Ohio State made Tennessee look like an FCS team in that game.
Yes, because there was because again the system you guys set up put the national champion in the first round, put the best team in the first round, and they blitzed the life out of Tennessee. It's hard not to swear. All right, I got to break.
Ross, you texted about this, and I think you're right. We do need to explain the TNT games. Why these games? So why is the best game Saturday at noon Eastern
at 11 a.m. local time? Texas A&M's biggest game, maybe in history, right? First playoff game is kicks off at 11 a.m. And obviously that's because ESPN didn't want to compete with the NFL. NFL games are that late afternoon window and then the primetime window. In those games, ESPN sublicensed to TNT. The games that will compete against the NFL are TNT games.
Well, that's the Gary Bears against the Green Bay Packers in primetime. Right. So
ESPN owning and controlling all of this and still simultaneously simping to the NFL is disgusting. And college football fans who don't care about the NFL should raise more hell about it.
Well, it's wild that starting next year, TNT will get a semifinal game. They already have two quarters starting next year, two first rounds starting next year. So ESPN will be having sold away half, not counting the championship game, half of the CFP games for three years, 2016.
It's almost as if ESPN has severely leveraged itself buying all these rights, not just to the college football playoff, but to Monday Night Football and the NBA. And now it's so leveraged that it's got to sell some of it because it needs the cash.
Or maybe they just shouldn't be the sole television partner of the entire postseason and have this amount of undue influence.
That would be the commissioner's fault, because they do, like, if only there was a football league that does it differently, that holds everybody over a barrel by selling its biggest product to multiple networks and makes more money that way.
You would need centralized governance, and that would come out of the dying hands of Greg Sankey. There's no way they're gonna afford governance to a centralized body.
If he was the centralized governor, I think he'd be okay with it.
Cold, dying grip.
Yes, an Eastern European type conglomeration of power, that could definitely happen, because this is college football. And what is not dirtier than college football? Just European soccer. That methodology could definitely occur. Greg Sankey takes over the sport, has most of us killed. Yeah, absolutely. Ross told myself,
by the way, killed Godfrey. You'd just be sent to Siberia.
I saw a Lane Kiffin tweet, by the way, this morning.
During the show?
At like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
No, it just kind of came back into my timeline.
Well, yoga starts at 5 a.m. your time.
Yeah, he quote tweeted Greg Sankey tweet from last night, which is a picture of Greg at clearly the SEC's like holiday party or something. And Greg is, Sankey is with like Santa, you know, somebody dressed up as Santa, whatever. And Lane quote tweeted and said,
Santa for the SEC.
Lane quote tweeted and said, "Good to see my commissioner and my agent together," as if Santa is Jimmy Sexton. Yeah, give it up for Lane, man.
Oh, I mean, you know what? Jimmy Sexton is Santa. He stops everybody's
Christmas tidings, doesn't he? Yes.
Hey, I love that. I'm going to be honest. Like, Lane lives in layers of deception and nonsense and attention-seeking behavior, but once in a while, he will call the thing what it is. So that's kind of awesome, to be honest.
Well, one other thing I was going to add, Andy, about the schedule. We're talking about the schedule and the games competing against the NFL. If the games were all last weekend, they wouldn't have competed against the NFL, right? That it's an open weekend. The NFL doesn't play. The one big thing is Army Navy is that weekend. They've tried to avoid.
Glad you mentioned that. Got Kirk Herbstreit in trouble for forgetting that.
Yeah, I was there. I remember. It happened.
Wasn't he there?
They tried to avoid. Huh? What?
Wasn't Kirk there?
At the game? I don't know.
He did a podcast where he and Joey Galloway were
there's no football
this weekend. So
I know, but was game day not live? I didn't watch.
No.
Was game day not live from Army Navy?
I don't think so.
Oh, interesting.
No.
Okay. I guess they bailed out because they hate the troops. At me, Bill.
the CFP tries to avoid playing on the second weekend because, one, Army Navy, obviously. Two, to give more teams more than a week from the conference championship games. And three, just give schools more time to prepare for an on-campus game. But I think in the 16-team playoff that they're talking about potentially doing, they're talking about not necessarily having 8 first-round games, because that's a lot of games in a lot of windows, and there's not enough windows, but having 2 games on the Army-Navy weekend, play-in type games where the 13 and the 16 seed play the 14 and the 15 seed. They play on the second weekend in December, and they play into the bracket that will really start.
Kill
the
next it with
week.
Fire. You have a 16-team
so
bracket.
Buys.
It's perfect if it's a perfect square.
But there are 8
kill
games,
it.
8 first round games, Andy.
Don't care.
And where are you going to put them?
Where put are you them on put my television. I don't care where or when.
Do people
put
not
them on
realize
my TV?
Do 2 on Friday or the second weekend in December and maybe try to scatter 6 on that Saturday. But
2 Thursday, 2 Friday, 4 Saturday. Make it like
Thursday,
the NCAA tournament, which is the greatest
NFL,
tournament in American sports.
You get the NFL again. But remember, too, Thursday would be 5 days after the conference championship games. You can't do that.
No, right? No, it's the following Thursday, Ross. You're mixing up plans.
Well, I'm talking about the whole goal is to play the second weekend of December. That's what they're trying to get to.
Just leave Army-Navy alone. Leave the troops alone. Good Lord.
By the way, both Army and Navy have contended for the G5 spot late into the season, so I'd love to see that one play out, the troop hating there. This is all just a...
They've established, Godfrey, that they're not going to count that game, basically.
I know,
So the selections would go, and they would
not good.
Guys, we have to pick the games that do count.
Yeah.
When we return, I got a feeling for the games and for the national champion. We're back at the College Football Inquirer. We got playoff games this weekend, and we're going to pick them.
You think football is still fun.
I feel great, man.
I have a bad feeling about this.
Stephen Godfrey going to pick a very interesting, maybe the most intriguing playoff game.
Yeah.
But you may not know about it because it's in the FCS playoffs, but we got a rematch in the FCS playoffs of a fabulous rivalry.
Yeah, I want to go to this game.
Is there a better rivalry name than Brawl of the Wild? Invented by a local journalist, I might add. It's our friends at Football Scoop, the headline says it all. Saturday's Bobcats Grizzlies semifinal rematch is the biggest sporting event in Montana's history, as in the state of. So, this is obviously a rematch of one of the best rivalries in college football. The winner here will move on to the national championship against the winner of the upstart Illinois State, who got me in the picks twice, I believe, and Villanova. So it's a non-Dakota national championship season, guys. There's some newish blood potentially going to play for the national championship at Vanderbilt Stadium here in Nashville, Tennessee. So I'll be at that game. I'm going to go with the favorite here. I'm going to go with Montana State. The idea of Montana State winning this game twice in the same season feels daunting. This game is in Bozeman. The first matchup was in Missoula. I feel semi-confident about this. It was a 31-28 win, by the way, earlier in the season. It was very close. This is going to be a fantastic game. Again, North Dakota State being out, I do think this is sort of the de facto national championship between these two. The environment here, we talk about first-round playoff games on the FBS level. If you get a second, I believe it's 2 p.m. Central, God's time zone, that this game starts. Just flip over, find this game. The environment in Bozeman is going to be like unlike anything else.
If Tulane really Ole Miss gets out of hand, you can just flip to this.
Absolutely. It's going to be, I guarantee you it will be closer than Tulane Ole Miss unless Tulane is just running an upset. Like, yeah. This is a game you really should incorporate into your viewing menu this weekend. I really, really do stump for like the football quality of this game.
What channel is it on? What is it on? Televised, right? ESPN, I guess. I'm guessing ESPN.
Yeah, they've got the whole FCS playoffs.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they put the first round on the app, and then after that, I think they actually allot cable channels to the subsequent rounds.
Okay.
So, similar situation. Team went on the road and beat this team. Now has a game at home against this team, Oklahoma, Alabama. This line has shockingly moved. What I think is a weird direction. It was Alabama by one for a lot of the week. As we record this, it's Alabama by 1.5, despite the fact that Alabama had the worst availability report news and Oklahoma had the better availability report news. So I'm a little shocked by that. I don't think a lot about this game makes much sense. So you'd think because Oklahoma beat them earlier, because the very bad Oklahoma beat the much better Alabama last year, that maybe there's some Brent Venables voodoo over Kalen DeBoer. I don't think that's the case. I think neither team can run the ball. I think this game will hinge on turnovers and turnover luck. And Oklahoma won the first one because of an 87-yard pick six return and because Alabama missed a field goal at the end of the first half in which the kicker yelled at the long snapper, which I've never seen before. Oklahoma does have the better kicker in Tate Sandell. He's best known for his booty shorts, but he also kicks bombs. But against all better judgment, I am picking Alabama to win this game. Give me Alabama minus 1.5.
Wow.
What a swerve. Wow.
Before we get to Ross real quick, ABC, 4 p.m. Eastern. I'm sorry for all the wild.
ABC,
ABC, baby, 4 p.m. Eastern. FCS.
Yes.
Let's go. All right.
Yes. The Aggies and the Canes down in College Station, excited about this one, despite the morning kickoff time, as we talked about. Hopefully, Andy, I can make it into the stadium. Might have to walk, like you mentioned earlier.
Maybe we'll pick you up at the airport.
Maybe so, yeah. Land at 9:30. So we've seen A&M at its best, going to Notre Dame and winning. We've seen it at its worst, going to Texas and playing really, really poorly. And we see Miami at the same thing, right? Two toe stubs of Miami, and the Hurricanes also beat Notre Dame. This is going to be like a really tight game. And I thought the 3.5 point spread was just too big for for either way. And I think the Canes with Malachi Toney have a real shot to win it. So I'm going to go with the Canes plus 3.5.
All right. So we've got first weekend picks. Obviously, we're picking Ole Miss and Oregon to win the other two games. Mm-hmm. Whether they cover the spreads or not, they don't care. They just want to advance. So
yep.
Let us talk about advancing through this tournament. Who wins the national championship? So, Godfrey, I'm going to come back to you first. Who you got?
Of the three hosts on this show, I travel to attend games the least. I have a different type of day job, if you will, so I'm always working on different projects. However, I have attended a smattering of college football this season, and some of that even involved FBS teams. Maybe it's my recency bias, my in-person evaluation, but I stood about field level for four quarters, and I watched the Georgia Bulldogs defensively dominate Texas, which was not the hardest thing in the world, given the decline of that offense this year. But what I also saw was a dynamic Georgia offense. One more time, just so that's not an editing error, I saw a dynamic Georgia offense. Gentlemen, I stood amongst the red and black. I stood amongst my genetic people in the state of Georgia, and they couldn't even yell at Bobo after the first quarter. Now, if that is not Haley's Comet, I don't know what is. In subsequent games, it may not have been as creative necessarily, but the way the Georgia Bulldogs look right now tells me that this could be a dominant national championship run.
We move on from the SEC homer to Ross Dellinger.
So we saw what Ohio State did last year. Lost the last regular season game before the playoff and went on a run. And I think we're going to see something similar this year. Lost the last game before the playoff against Indiana, the Big Ten championship game. And I just think the Buckeyes are too talented. Perhaps have, three or four of the top 10 players in college football on one team. I think it's enough for them to go on the run here and win the national championship. Over, I don't know. I know we weren't.
Yeah, go ahead. Who's on the other side of the bracket?
But yeah, what do you got?
Other side of the bracket, I've got a little surprise. The Red Raiders
making
it to the national championship game. Yes, sir. And by the way, that segues into really quickly, Andy. I'll say how important it is this playoff for the ACC, the Big 12, and perhaps the Group of Five, but certainly the ACC, the Big 12. To win games, all right? Mm-hmm. Because they were 0-4 last year, that group. In the results of the playoff, I do think impact ongoing playoff format conversations.
So on that side of the bracket, my prediction is going to come into direct conflict with your prediction in the Orange Bowl. So last year, Oregon had the best regular season of anybody. They were 13-0. They won the Big Ten. They beat Ohio State in the regular season. They looked like a juggernaut. They then sit and wait. They get to Pasadena, and they hit a buzzsaw known as Ohio State that had a chance to get warmed up and start spinning against Tennessee in that first round. This year, Oregon, not sitting around, did not play in the Big Ten championship game. So if they're a little rusty, they're going to get a tune-up against James Madison. When they hit the Orange Bowl, that saw is going to be spinning. You hear Evan Stewart's back in practice, DeCorian Moore back to full health. All of a sudden, the offense that Oregon envisioned, which, by the way, they have not had all season, could be what you see in the playoff. So suddenly, a team that was already one of the most talented teams in the field is even more talented. So I look at Oregon kind of similarly to the way I looked at Ohio State in last year's playoff. And so I will pick, and this is not just a Curry favor with our producer TJ, but give me the Oregon Ducks to win the Natty.
So in the interest of CYA, Andy picked first when we were doing our pre-show. I wanted to pick Oregon. I wanted to provide an argument for a different team, but I do think it's going to be Georgia-Oregon, and I do think I said dominant Georgia. I think that game's going to be close. I like Georgia as much as Andy does.
And that's the thing. So I was at that Georgia-Texas game too, saw the same things you did.
Yeah.
Georgia looks like a team because we're trying to figure out. Actually, Ross's pick of Ohio State is the safest pick and the most logical pick. He's right that they have the most talented team in the field, the most best players, if that makes sense. They also have the hardest path because they're going to have to play the winner of A&M Miami, and then they're going to have to play the winner of, we think, Georgia Ole Miss. That is a really tough path to get to the national title game.
Yeah, losing that Big Ten championship game had consequences. And for it to come down to a field goal, I know that's brutal. But I have faith in Ohio State because they got a good-looking quarterback. I tell you what, looks very similar to somebody else I know.
You do have the same hair as Julian Sain.
Gojo's been doing this for like 3 weeks. He's been putting up a picture of me and Sain. So, yeah. Also, Klubnik has this haircut.
I don't think I realized this until just now. And Mike Golic Jr., I have to text him way ahead of the curve. Yes, your hair does match Julian Sain's exactly.
Yep.
And we're maybe a couple Julian Sain hair flips away from him hoisting the trophy. So
you know what? It's an elite club. I feel confident about my guy. I feel like he's going to do well in the playoff. It's not going to come down to the kicking game.
Well, when next you hear from us, we'll have playoff results and a more filled out bracket. We will know the quarterfinal matchups. We'll be back Sunday. Break it all down for you on the College Football Inquirer.